Your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. A pleasant good evening to the nation. I have the pleasure of having both my co-hosts today, Dr. Wesley Francis, general surgeon and Bahamian surgical oncologist, and businessman, entrepreneur, and publisher, Mr. Ian Fernander. And we have the greatest of pleasures, I would say, one of the most esteemed. Well, we always have important guests, but I would say he's could be argued to be the most esteemed guest we've had on this show thus far in the past 21 months. And that's national icon and legend, and I would say Bahamian treasure, Mr. Patrick Ramming, who is a preeminent Bahamian architect. Everybody knows Pat Ramming. Playwright, he's a poet, he's a songwriter, he's a novelist, an essayist, innovative thinker and philosopher. He's a community and cultural activist, an actor, a guitarist. He's known for Bahamian music. He's also a very successful businessman and author. He has a new book that he's written. It's called Lattice, Louvers, and Leaves, Celebrating Shade in Bahamian Architecture. He's a senior statesman, almost 82 years old, but he's looking very young, and it's a pleasure for him to be here. So good evening, gentlemen, and a special good evening to you, Mr. Pat Ramming.
Good evening. Wonderful to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So when everybody hears Pat Ramming, there's so many different ways people see you. Obviously, you're a very well-known and respected architect. I know my uncles have used you for decades. I have used you in the last decade several times, and have greatest respect for you and your work as an architect. I was in Queens College High School with your son, and I remember you coming several times to sing for all of us, and that was the first time I heard Bahamian folk music live, and it was very inspirational. But you have done so much for this country, and I think we need to honor you. And we need to speak about all that you've contributed and continue to contribute, because you're very active even in your eighth decade on this earth. Can you speak a little bit about this book as a publisher, Mr. Ian Fernander?
Well, what is amazing for us about the book is that Mr. Ramming has penned so much in his life. His books, with his plays, because he's a playwright. He has books of poetry, and now he has a novel as well that has come out. He's written so many things, and people have seen those writings. But this is the first time he's writing on his profession, at least one of his professions, his mainstay profession, which is architecture. And there's some people that, when you mention Pat Ramming, because they have seen him in the cultural light, they forget or don't know that this is the gentleman who designed the first national insurance building. This is the gentleman who designed the straw market and other national places, and that he has lived in a world of design all of his life, and he has a lot to say about Bahamian architecture.
Well, Mr. Pat Ramming has touched so many Bahamians from all walks of life and various ages, various generations. I know you, Dr. Wesley Francis, you know him as a fraternity brother. How, as Mr. Pat Ramming influenced your life, and what can you say about Pat Ramming, the Bahamian icon?
Well, I know Pat Ramming as Archon Pat, and he understands that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that, you know, growing up, you knew that name as a cultural icon. Didn't know that he was an architect until later on in life. But then, you know, the cultural aspect of what he did was always something that we knew as we grew up through school, primary school, high school. We definitely knew what he did, his poetry, his music, all of that penetrated, and we celebrated him. I remember in high school, you know, being the beneficiary of him coming and reading poetry to us. And then later on in life, as we now, and we are part of a fraternity, and getting to know the best of him, and he understands that. Mm-hmm. So it's a pleasure for me to sit here next to, I'll call him Archon Pat, because he understands that,
mm-hmm.
And share this this podium with him, and truly humbled, because I know I'm sitting next to an icon.
A national hero. There's no debate about that. His life will echo in the history books of this country for forever. How many songs have you written? I know many of your songs, Bainetown being one of them, but how many songs have you written, Mr. Pat Ramming?
I have no idea.
Too many to count. What are some of your favorites, and what are some of the more
Omwale is probably the most favorite of all.
Okay.
Maybe because of what it represented for me.
Okay.
But the racetrack song,
Are you still performing? And that is amazing.
But I just told someone a couple of weeks ago my next concert will be in 2028.
Okay. All right. And you're still involved in various aspects of your architectural firm as well.
Yes.
So I think that is in itself inspiring to this country, because we have a nation where I believe we retire too young. For many in government, women are retiring at 60, men at 65. Again, I don't really understand that disparity based on gender. But if we're going to live to 85, if we're going to live to 90, why are we retiring at 60, 65? And there's a surprising link between early retirement and death risk. One of the most dangerous years of your adult life might be the actual year that you retire, because there's a real spike in mortality, particularly for those who retire before the age of 62. So due to the possible maybe questions such as the loss of purpose, the loss of routine, reduced activity, isolation from community. There's so many reasons for that, but I think the solution is, even if you do retire, that let that be the beginning of your second career. Don't stop working if you love it, or find something that you do love and continue to do for the next 20, 25 years. There's a lot of risk with dementia as well. Increased risk of Alzheimer's with lack of mental stimulation. So you need to keep yourself physically active. You need to keep yourself mentally active. You need to be a part of your community. You don't need to isolate yourself. And essentially, you need to find something meaningful to wake up to do. Something that you can't wake up soon enough, that you want to start your day because you're so excited to do that. And many times, you make sacrifices. You do a job you may not particularly love, just to pay the bills, to get your children through to university, to support your family, support your wife, your extended family, pay the mortgage, pay the rent, pay the car insurance, whatever bills. But once you're retired and you have a little bit of a nest egg, the kids are out the house, only people visiting you are your grandkids, that's the time to do and find hobbies or things, or even a second profession that you love. Obviously, you have so many loves.
You know, there's an interesting thing. Listening to you talk about retirement makes it sound as though retirement is a natural thing. retirement, retirement was invented during the industrial age.
Yes.
As a way to get people who could no longer keep up on the assembly line out of the way so younger people could step in. You didn't retire. You were retired.
Yes.
Right? We're no longer in the industrial age.
I completely agree.
We're in the information age at the moment. So the question of retirement has no validity anymore. None at all. I agree that we've structured our lives in so many ways that it's very difficult to talk about, you know, eliminating it. But the reality is exactly what you just said, that there's nothing natural about retiring.
We always got to keep moving. We have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks. Good evening. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Is that Pat O'Dell?
Yes, it is.
Is that Pat O'Dell?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Pat, how you doing?
I'm excellent.
Pat, you doing Sparky?
Yes, Sparky.
Man, look at
Pat. I thought you were sleeping by now, Sparky.
Hold on, Pat, let's talk the story now. Let's talk the story. Mm. The Bain Down gal is the most favorite one.
Bain Down woman.
Yeah. The Bain Down gal is the most favorite one.
Yeah.
And the next favorite one is my cousin, Eric Mintz. I got a Fox Hill
gal.
Yeah. That was my Aunt Esther up in Fox Hill.
I see.
Hello. Pat Graham, yeah. Did we play American football on the Eastern Parade?
Yes, sir.
Hold on, I can't hear. I still don't. I need to pull on the side of the road. Hold on, the car. Hold on. Pull on the side. The car engine making noise. But, hey, Pat, how you hear me now?
I can hear you. Loud and clear.
The woman wouldn't pull on the car, stop the car. Okay, Pat, let the Bahamian people know. Let the Bahamian people, we need to talk our stories. Hello, Pat?
Which part of the story you want to tell us about?
We got to talk all our stories. The Valiumoys, the Saxons, all the Junkanoo and all the things. We never write no book. We never told the stories. We never did nothing. All we talk about politics, PLP, FNM, this and that and next. But tell us about Pat. Tell
Sparky,
us about these
Sparky.
Stories.
I tell you what, give us a chance, and we're going to be telling you a bit more story right now.
But hold on, Pat. Hold on, Pat. On Monday, I will be 75 years old.
Young fellow.
Mostly me and your friends are dead and gone.
Mm-hmm.
We can't wait to tell our stories. We need to get it out now.
That's what Mr. Pat Raming is here for. Let's continue with the stories. Thank you for your call, Sparky. So everybody knows you as an icon, and I am not reserved in saying that. Tell us about where you grew up. Were you born in New Providence? What was your life like growing up, and what inspired you to become an architect and a cultural icon?
Well, I was born in New Providence. I was born in Grantstown, actually, right behind the Grantstown Post Office.
Wow.
I grew up in Baintown. My grandmother, I grew up with my grandmother, Ethel Roll. Went to St. Joseph's and then Woodcock Primary and then Weston Junior, Weston Senior, and eventually Government High. So I spent most of my early life in the Baintown and Grantstown area. Eventually went off to university and got an architectural degree. I think I also got an education, because much of the time that I was away, I was able to participate in sports and in cultural activity and performing, etc. And I think that was the education part of it, the degree part of it, was becoming an architect.
Do you think we're losing part of our cultural heritage? I just from a personal standpoint, I'm very sad that the radio station that Charles Carter and Eddie Carter had, where primarily they would play Bahamian music and keep it alive in our hearts, in our minds, is now no more. Do you think that we do enough to keep our Bahamian culture alive?
No. I think one of the things that we have been trying to do is to find some single thing that we can call our culture to hold on to. Well, that's not what culture is. You know, culture is the way people live. And the many things that we do on a day-to-day basis that we enjoy doing together, the things that make us unique because of the ways we approach life. I was just saying to Ian just before we got here, it's if you were sitting in a restaurant and you heard a couple of people order breakfast, and they ordered, one ordered stew fish and Johnny cake, the other one ordered boiled fish and grits. And the guy who ordered boiled fish and grits says, and I'll take the head. Well, do you know how many ways that separates you from the rest of the world? First of all, there are very few people in the world who would have fish for breakfast.
Correct, yes.
Secondly, those that do have fish would never eat the head. So when you sit in a restaurant and you have boiled fish for breakfast, you're expressing your culture, right? What we want to do, we want to find something that you could sort of paint green and yellow and say, that's our culture.
I understand.
The reason we've lost a lot of the music, the dance, the fellowship we used to have is that we're looking for something that we think would satisfy somebody else, not satisfy us.
I understand. Well, I'm going to let your fraternity brother question you about what inspired you regarding this book and the details of this book.
No, I mean, your Sparky mentioned something which I think is very important. And, you know, as we go on, And keeping the culture alive is also passing it on to generations behind us. And one of the ways to pass it on, if you think about it, I mean, I don't know how much the book costs, but I'm certain that in his lifetime, what he has put into this book, the cost of that is it's what you're paying for all of that. Mm-hmm. And so what inspired you to do the book? And what is it that you want us to glean from this book?
The Lattice book you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
I was fortunate when I came home from school to have been hired by one of the most brilliant Bahamian architects so far. His name was Donald Cartwright. And very few people will probably remember Donald. Very quiet fellow. But he was a very good architect. And he was very passionate about understanding what architecture is in the context of the Bahamas. And so the lessons I learned from him, I think had a lot to do with what ended up as my body of work. One of the disappointments of the 50 odd years, nearly 60 years that I practice, is that the architects in the country don't speak to the country. You'll notice that there's been things like people tearing down historic buildings, and nobody says anything about it. I mean, it's incredible. Government decides that it's going to create a new building that's meant to be an important building to the society. And the way it chooses where it's going to go is by, oh, we have a piece of land over there, why don't we use that? Not a master plan that says, this is where your special buildings go.
I understand, right? Yes.
And this approach to the built environment has an impact on the citizens. How do I know how important I am if my environment doesn't tell me that I'm important? And so one of the things that Donald helped me understand was how we approach climate. The most important part of what we do is understanding that there's a breeze that allows you to get creature comfort.
Yes.
And the way to get that breeze is to open the window on one side of the building and let it flow through to the other side of the building. The other thing you have to do is to keep the sun out of the building.
Yes.
And so you have to find some shade device. And that's why we talk about the lattice, the leaves, trees, and the louvers as ways of keeping the sun outside the building to create creature comfort. What that also does is it says, this is the part of the world that you are in. The Eskimo don't have that same problem.
I got it, yes.
Right. And so your personality is being determined by the way in which you approach the design of your environment. And then the question of sort of cultural and personal importance. If you travel, as you travel around the world, you walk past, you know, a statue of Sir Christopher Wren or something, and you don't have to know anything about Sir Christopher Wren. What you know is Sir Christopher Wren had some importance to something.
Yes.
And if you happen to be from his neighborhood, that importance falls on you. You know that you're also important because he was important. Give you an example. I was not a cricket player, but my father was one of the three best cricket players in the history of the country.
Okay.
So if I walk into a room full of cricket aficionados, they don't call me Pat. They call me Angst Boy.
I got it.
Right? Because Ank was their hero. And because Ank was their hero, my chest goes out. Because I'm important because Ank was important.
Understood. Right? Understood.
Our children deserve the same things, but we keep avoiding it. And hopefully in the book, we don't get as deep into that as I'd like to get, but you'll begin to see hints of that kind of how does your built environment contribute to your national development?
Well, what I would say is you've led such a fascinating life, and definitely your life alone would be a wonderful documentary. And I think that would immortalize what you have stood for through the years and for future generations. Mm-hmm. I think that would be, filmography is all important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, having a book is wonderful. Mr. Ian Fernanda, you are integral, obviously, as a publisher and going hand in hand and getting this book out. You actually are also, you have many hats, you are also a photographer. Tell us about some of the buildings that were portrayed or illustrated in this book.
Well, we wanted to capture as many of Pat's buildings in the flesh as possible, but we also have some drawings in the book as well for the persons who are into seeing that part of Pat. So it's photography of the National Insurance Building, the headquarters, which I'm happy to say I found out is a beautiful building. I just never thought about looking at it that way. But when you have to take photographs of a building like that, you discover how beautiful it is. And then you talk to Pat about the intention of his design, and you find it even more beautiful when you find that out. And he describes some of his intentions in the book. The Straw Market, another one of his buildings, being able to go inside and look for some of the things that he said he deliberately designed into the building, and the purpose of the way the roof was structured and the way things were structured to capture the breeze, because the Straw Market was not air conditioned. Mm-hmm. It was intended to be cool. Wonderful experience in photographing many of the structures that Pat has designed, understanding the reason why he designed them that way.
Mr. Ramey, do you think we're losing part of our Bahamian identity in terms of architecture, particularly for residential homes throughout the country? We have communities springing up all over New Providence and the Family Islands. There's a lot of debate whether we should limit the number of floors, the height of these buildings. Do you agree with that?
No. No, I think you know, you live in a world where the expression of technology is one of the things your children look forward to. If you have safety issue, then obviously, yes, you can create those limits, but you can't create a limit on dreaming. You need to create opportunities for your children to dream.
Understood.
What other people have done to recognize this is that they've said, you know, there's a personality that we have that we'd like to some extent maintain or make available as we move forward. And so we say, for this part of town, this is an historic zone, and it has its own building code and its own regulations. And you can only go so high and this distance between buildings and that kind of thing. Makes a lot of sense. And many, especially urban cities, have been very successful doing it. And I think for us, we should have done something like that a long time ago.
Well, I guess it's never too late. It's never too late. Mm-hmm. We have another call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Hey, a pleasure. Good evening, Doctor, and good evening to your guests as well.
Good evening.
You know, I grew up in the early 60s, 70s, and would be called the Black Village at the time. But I still live basically in the area. You know, just the other day as I was walking along Blue Hill Road, heading south, you know, your mind began to think as you remember historic, you know, main buildings that were in certain places. And then you see how, you know, things are changing. I remember when we Edmund Moxey first started Jumbe Village, and how all that was like just, you know, bush and the go swim in Big Pond and stuff like that. And I said, I wonder if any of this is being documented, if somebody come back and say how this area used to look 50 years or so ago. And even as, you know, as they were building the cruise port, you know, and just we see just in a couple of years, everything the way that it was, it just, you know, it was just totally different. And I just, you know, I wondered if, you know, if they could just put up some pictures, say, and show the progress of the people who come after us or come, you know, would say, wondered, you know, this is how it used to be. And it almost reminds me of a scripture in the Bible where it says that there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, that, you know, sometimes people don't really understand or respect the contributions that are, you know, made by others. And I agree with Mr. Ramin, you know, a lot of the historic buildings and whatnot, and I guess in some other countries, you know, they are artifacts, but we just seem to destroy things and call it progress and really to get rid of the old. But we need to find a way to let the old and the new, because we need the old sometimes to remind us where we were, and the new to tell us where we're going.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And guess what? Not only are you correct in terms of what we as a community need, I mean, that's a part of our memory system. We need to do that, and we need to do it for several reasons. But guess what? Our nation is in a business called tourism. And in that business, the item that's being sold is the story of the destination. That's what's being sold in any tourist destination. And so what you are talking about is why people create things they call museums.
Right.
A museum is not really a place where you can learn about the way it used to be. And in so doing, be able to talk about the way it can be in the future. But it's also a part of you telling your story. And that is critically important, especially at the moment. So I think what you're saying is absolutely correct. And I hope that you can put some legs on that.
I have an idea. I think I forget her name. I think a Dr. Turner or somebody at the archives department. You know, even these graveyards, these historic graveyards and stuff like that. They're so valuable. There's so many things that we can do. You know,
well,
I think it takes. I think somebody has said that we don't have a separate Ministry of Culture, and everything is so convoluted. Everything is so mixed up, and you know, and that you don't have some. One who is focused, who is intentionally focused on one area, but just all over the place, you know.
You know, you are so, yeah. You are so, on
point. We need, Mr. Rami, we need our national development plan so that we have something that successive governments will build on, and we have a direction as to where we want to go instead of this. Just this hodgepodge of when one government comes in, they do what they want, another one comes in, you know. We need to focus on our national development plan so that we can, as a country, as Mr. Felix says, and it must come from the bottom up, not from the top down. So we, as a country, as a citizens, that we decide which direction we want to go.
Well, you just said two things that I've got to really encourage you to see if you could find a way to move forward on. The graveyard analogy you just used, I have often pointed out to people that the city of New Orleans is a very successful city in tourism. And its second most important attraction is its graveyard. As you probably know, New Orleans is built below sea level.
Sea level, yes.
So their graves have to be above the ground. Mm. And that has led to the most incredible space.
Wow.
And it's a huge tourist attraction. But graveyards everywhere.
Yeah.
Attract visitors.
Well, thank you for your call, and thank you, Pat Raming, for those interesting comments. We always try to promote on this show, Dr. Wesley Francis, obviously good quality living, longevity. I think I first met Mr. Pat Raming when I was in school 40 years ago, and he's as vibrant as ever, and I'm sure a lot of that has to do with him being active, active, active. In fact, I would say you've lost some weight now. You're looking better than you did 40 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
Not that you didn't look good then, but you look the picture of health. And obviously your mind is as quick as a whip. What do you think of mandatory retirement in this age, Dr. Wesley Francis, in terms of what the outlook is, longevity for the nation?
Well, again, and I think Pat said it best, I think we have to think about people, the value add, what value that a person can add or contribute, whether it's to whatever sector they're part of, right? As he'd mentioned, we talked about the industrial age. People were on the assembly line. Obviously, that kind of work that is required as you get older, you may not be as efficient. Mm-hmm. And so obviously then you would want, and again, this is in business, this is about efficiency, you would want a younger person in that. But as people age, their value proposition changes, and what they can add to the sector, to the community, or to, you know, government changes. And so this is why you have to shift. And you had mentioned about second career and all of that. But instead of considering and thinking about as a retirement, you're thinking about how your value shifts or your contribution shifts and becomes more valuable to whatever sector that you're in. And I think if we think like that, then again, the whole idea of retirement doesn't, first of all, it still allows for succession and allows for younger people to come in, but it also allows for institutional memory and for us to continue to develop and not forget the history or not lose the history from whence you came. And so I think that's the way that we should probably look at not retirement, but progression.
Okay. And then, and Dr. Francis, I want to add something to this. An example from my life, about 15 years ago when I had an accident and my femur and hip were smashed, my leg that I'm walking on today was saved by a retired orthopedic surgeon who walked in when they were about to, they decided they'd have to cut my leg off, and walked in and says, "No, you don't have to do that. I know how to save that." And they were looking at him like, "What are you talking about?" But it saved. Mm-hmm. Because the younger guys did not have the wealth of experience that that retired orthopedic surgeon had, and just looked at it and said, he knew how to save it, and he'll tell them how to do it, and it was done. So we can't disabuse ourselves of the experiences in our society. And as people get very experienced, I'm convinced they get more valuable. But we tend to think that as a person gets more experience, they're more expendable, which is an interesting thing that we put into our society.
I mean, there was a long-term study that I read a few years ago that showed that persons who retire between the age of 55 and 62 had a 37% greater risk of dying by the age of 65. Mm-hmm. So we have in our society, let's talk about Defense Force officers. Most of them are forced to retire. Career officers who have a wealth of experience have many, probably even two more decades to contribute to the defense of our country. And they're forced to retire at 55. I think that's wrong. I think we need to relook at that. We need to relook at persons in government having to retire at 60, 65. Obviously, there are a lot of persons who are called back and allowed to work because they're in good health, and even into their 70s, approaching 80. And
so I think we got to look at the role that they play. I don't believe a 55-year-old Defense Force officer should be on the street, right? Manning or trying to, whatever they do, or be the primary sailor on the boat, right? So your roles change as you get older and as you get more experienced. So, but if we think of it as just being finite or linear, then that is when we will say, okay, 55, you got to go. But it's the idea that, well, you can contribute so much more in a different role at 56, or whatever age that you go on. But it just shows that development has to, it's a continuum. And then that's where you go.
You know, there was a comment made earlier about maybe doing something, looking to find something to do after you retire. And I think what is really being said is this, that the word retire has become like a burden for us. We got to figure out how to handle it. Because in reality, for most of us, life doesn't stop when we retire. Even if we don't consciously do it, we continue looking for opportunities to be useful. We continue looking for opportunities to do things we never did before, right? And so the problem is not this institution called retirement. It's us thinking that life is like Coca-Cola. It gets refrigerated until it reaches a point, and then it spoils. You throw it out.
We have another call coming in. Sorry for the wait. This is Urologist Speaks.
Hello, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I heard the voice and I called not knowing exactly what I was going to talk about. Mr. Rumming.
Yes,
sir. Yes, Hutchison here.
Yes, Mr. Hutchison.
How you doing, man?
I'm extremely well, Edward.
Well, you sound good, man.
Well,
looks good, too.
I got friends like you that won't allow me to sound different.
I tell you. Now, in the midst of the conversation, I kind of stumbled on exactly what I wanted to talk about. You know, that we have a culture.
Yes, sir.
A political culture that does not bear up too well in light of the wisdom that the older folks have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, for some reason, we have a problem with transition, passing on to the next generation what the students are. And, and in a conversation that you had with the last man, right?
Mm-hmm.
It suddenly occurred to me that we have made a grave disservice of attaching sports to culture in the same industry. In no other place in the world you will find culture connected to any other thing. It stands alone. It's separate and apart. But as it relates to the tourism product, we now have a situation where we have our islands being farmed out, and our product is actually being co-opted by these larger companies. But what I find amazing is that when you look at their ads on the TV, they make no mention of the Bahamas as its location. They make no mention at all of what our location is or where this product, all they know is that something in the Caribbean, someplace, and it's tranquil. I think, we need to step back and just, refocus. But if this keeps up, it's going to be very difficult to have what we call a Bahamian tourist Pollock. Now, the issue is not the Bahamian to his father. The issue is that we're going to devolve in what we see as culture. And when that goes, stuff just falls behind it, man. But I'm so happy to see my friend, to hear my friend on the radio. I mean, you know, we have had so many conversations about all kinds of stuff. You know, he always has a view that, you know, it's like you're talking to an older person who is wise, who I mean, like, even now, he has a lot more to offer than he had to offer previously, now, actually. Oh, man. Anyway,
Thanks, Ed. Wonderful talking to you again. Haven't spoken to you for a little while, but give me a buzz and we'll continue of that.
Yes, big brother.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your call. You made a lot of interesting points. I've been on Bahamian cruises and they've stopped at the numerous keys that are said to be in the Bahamas. But when you go there, there's nothing that is promoted that's Bahamian. None of the music they're playing is Bahamian. Most of the people working on these keys are not Bahamian. So we are losing our identity. We're selling out our product, and I don't know what we're really deriving from that, because the typical Bahamian makes nothing from it.
Can I give you another way of seeing that?
Please go ahead, sir.
Okay. There is a business called tourism.
Yes.
We are not in the business. We are landlords.
Very well said, yes.
What we do is we lease or sell property to people who are in the business.
I got it, yes. Okay. Well, when we just mentioned Mr. Fernando, a senior orthopedic surgeon, you obviously know who that is, saved your leg, changed the trajectory of your life, allowed you to do things such as publishing this book. One of the most taxing, stressful jobs on earth. There are very few jobs where you literally have somebody's life in your hand. You have a scalpel in your hand. A cut in one inch direction can cause significant morbidity or mortality. But I've seen it here. I've seen it throughout my career. I've seen it internationally throughout many countries. And you've seen it as well, Dr. Francis. Some of the most astounding and skilled surgeons are actually in their mid-70s, late 70s. Going through my university, as some of the best professors I had with the most keen minds and insight were late 70s and 80s. So if someone can cope as a surgeon at 78, at 79, and that's happening in the Bahamas now, I think there's no limit to what an individual can accomplish in this country, even if it means that if as a teacher you become a mentor to junior teachers, or you become a consultant to different schools, the same with the police, the same with the Defense Force, it's the same with industries including tourism. I think that we cast aside some of the best and brightest because of age, and we talk about sexism, racism. We're talking about ageism.
That's right.
You shouldn't try to put somebody in a box because of their age. In fact, you should have greatest of respect. And I think as our generations have gone on decade by decade, we are losing the respect for our elders. And I think that is one of the fall drawbacks of our society. We're losing our sense of self, and that includes our respect for our parents, for our elders, for our neighbors, for those that can inspire us and tell us and sit down and give us the stories and give us a broad perspective of, you know what, I've had 3 businesses, 2 of them failed. This is what went wrong. This is what I see happening in our country now. Let me give you some insight so you don't have to go down this path and have a business fail in 8 years and have to pick up again. Maybe what I'm imparting to you can prevent you from going down that path and being a success in 2 years instead of in 12 years. So we need to basically embrace those who are seniors, not cast them aside. And I think you are a shining example. I have used you as an architect. I have friends who have used you as an architect, and we all think you are one of the greatest Bahamian architects, not even getting into you as a poet, as a playwright, as a columnist, and everything else.
Well,
so
thank you.
You are obviously know Pat very well, Mr. Ian Fernander. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you have learned that you didn't know about Mr. Pat Ramey and what you found to be inspirational.
Well, I think one of the amazing things about Pat Ramey is something I've learned over time, and that he is unafraid to move away from his comfort zone. So I think that is incredible. A lot of us are taught to be where we are comfortable, but Pat has no problem moving away from the things that he is comfortable with, good at, and delving into areas, working his mind through problems that he probably, people say he has no business looking at. So if you read his newspaper columns, he's a guy who's talking about all sorts of issues. And it's like, why is this guy talking about the church or about this thing? He talks about everything and has good ideas about everything. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about him. He is a great creative, which is an example of why of telling you he's not afraid to make things out of nothing. So he's a playwright, songwriter. In fact, he just did a play the other day, and I think he's about to put on some more plays and throw out the Bahamas.
Amazing,
incredible person.
I mean, and the name of the book again?
The name of the book on architecture is Lattice, Louvers, and Leaves.
Celebrating
shade in architecture in the Bahamas.
And how can our public get a hold of this book?
Well, the book is about to be printed, and once it gets to be widely available in different places, so that will come out, and people will know where to get it.
And we'll be able to order it online as well. Is that the goal?
Eventually, be able to order it online. I should mention that Pat, in the interim, has written his a novel, at least a novel that has been printed, If God Spares Life, which has just come out of hot off the press. It's an interesting novel, especially in this political season, because it does talk a lot about politics, although it's a novel. Mm-hmm. And persons might, who especially someone mentioned, we have a political culture. Instead of having a culture. And so we might be very interested in reading If God Spares Life, a very good novel.
Well, at the onset of this radio show, Mr. Pat Ramey and Dr. Wesley Francis mentioned their fraternity brothers. Dr. Francis, what do you think the importance of lodges, fraternities, have in our society? There's so much in the way of negativity for men in particular, young men, middle-aged men, older men, when they come together and do community projects, when they come together and inspire each other business-wise, educationally, provide scholarships, do outreach. What do you think, first of all, what has a fraternity done for you as a surgeon, as a Bahamian, as a father, as a husband? And what would you say to inspire someone to join a fraternity or join some, or a lodge?
You know, a fraternity is as what it says, right? It's a group that has common ideals. And, you know, the fraternity that Pat and I are a part of, what the whole motto is getting to know the best of one another. And that's really what we do. We get to know the best of one another. And men tend to sharpen each other, and through that relationship then comes out the advocacy, the community involvement, and uplifting people around. But really, it's the bond, and I think a lot of people may not appreciate or understand that that's the bond that fraternity brings, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing about a fraternity too, there's sometimes a whole lot of secrecy around it. And because it takes you through an initiation process that bonds you and that gives you the identity and makes you recognize each other and the value that you are to each other. And so for me, the fraternities that I belong to, I have a brotherhood that I could always depend on, that that I know that if I'm in any situation, that I could always find a brother who would have perhaps been through that situation, who could perhaps uplift me. And also it's a community that allows me to provide charity and to provide togetherness and to promote basically community living.
Very well said, and I think it's very inspirational. And there are a lot of things that are being done in our community that are unsung. There are a lot of positive things, particularly you mentioned what you guys do in the fraternity. Now and then you may hear a few things, but a lot of things are done, and it's unheralded. But there are wonderful things being done by wonderful Absolutely. Men in this country. And I don't think we as a country embrace that enough and look at the positivity. That's why we are here trying to inspire and talk about positive things. We're here with a Bahamian icon on so many levels. So 6 decades, Mr. Pat Ramming, in architecture. So that means involved in building and involved with dealing with contractors and everything else. How have you seen, just in terms of the cost of living for a middle-aged family to buy a home, what is going wrong? Because now it's become almost an unreachable goal for a middle-aged couple who are educated or skilled or just even a typical new family to live in a home of their own. They'll be renting for the rest of their life. Why has the cost of a typical home become out of reach for a typical Bahamian family?
Well, first of all, I don't know that the cost has become out of reach, because I've taken a look at quite a few of what I would have called expensive developments. And they're all full. And they're full of Bahamians. So I don't know who it's out of reach for.
Well, we have a land full of opportunity, and we have a lot of persons who excel. But I think there's a great divide between the haves and the have-nots, and we're losing the middle class.
I'm going to be very argumentative about that, because here's the problem. There has never been a time, and there probably will never be the time, when what you can afford and what I can afford will be the same thing.
Yes, understood.
We all make our choices in life about what we're going to do with our lives that impact what we're going to be able to do with our lives. Mm-hmm. And those choices is what determines what we can afford and what we can't afford. What has happened is that over the last 50 years, primarily politics has convinced us that there is such a thing as the small man. I was having a conversation earlier about the fact that in the 1950s, the way a young man got his house was not to go out and borrow some money and hire a contractor. He himself generally had some skills, whether they were fine skills or rough skills. And he had people around him who had skills. And so the process of getting his house included getting his friends to come help him dig his foundation on one Saturday and come back the next Saturday and pour in the foundation.
Yes, right? Those days are gone for the most part.
Well, but that is what has happened. The house hasn't changed.
Understood.
It's how people have chosen to get the house.
Yes.
Now they want to be able to go to the bank, borrow $1 million, and say to the contractor, give me this house and I want all the stuff that I see on TV in the house, right?
Yes.
So the fact that they can't afford it is not the house's fault. There are still ways for people to be able to afford their houses, but it takes them looking at their lifestyle. It takes them looking at how they prepare to be able to afford the house.
Well, my counterpoint would be, for example, persons who want to give a life of service, teachers, nurses, for example, police officers, they're grossly underpaid. Over the decades, their increase in salary has not been on par with inflation. So where their dollar would go 10 years ago, 20 years ago, is a fraction of where it would go now. But the cost of building, the cost of living, has gone up exponentially, unfortunately. So yes, you may want to choose a career or a path that will provide you a fair compensation, but for some people, their path is drawn by, I want to give back service.
And let me tell you, what you're saying is absolutely correct. What you're drawing a line to, or putting a light on, is how we approach the politics of our life. When government looks at its population, instead of saying the teacher can't afford a house because they don't have money,
yes,
they ought to be saying either let's pay the teacher some more money, or they ought to be saying here is a program that subsidizes a teacher's house that does not subsidize a banker's house.
I agree with that, and I would support that full-heartedly. So this hour has gone very quickly. Mr. Ramming, I've known you for years. You have an open invitation. I would love you to come back and speak about this book, more books that you've written, and your impact on our closing remarks to the country.
Well, when I was invited to come on to the show, I thought to myself, what am I going to be able to contribute to a show?
Oh, you have so much to contribute.
but it has been fun. And I think I appreciate the fact that you are attempting to help people understand where we are and where we can go. And we need more of that in our society. I think we spend way too much time comparing ourselves to white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans.
Yes,
as a standard of living, not only a standard of life, but a standard of living. I like the way you approach your show.
I appreciate it. We're trying to be positive. Mr. Ian Fernando, any closing remarks?
Well, just says wonderful to have Pat on the show, and he is an example of how you can be steadfast in who you are and also continually grow in who you are. Someone, when he was born in Grantstown and grew up in Baintown, was not an architect, was not a poet, was not any of these things, and has become those things, and is still becoming even more things in his 80s. That's an incredible story.
And any words of tribute or closing remarks to your fraternity brother, Mr. Pat Ramming, Dr. Francis?
I think he said it all, and we just celebrate him.
Kudos to him. He's an icon that we need to honor and respect, and we need to learn from the path that he's gone down and learn from his life experiences. It's a wealth of information that's invaluable, and we would love to have you come back and talk about other aspects of our society. Thank you again, Mr. Pat Ramming. It's truly been an honor, and please, I would like to call you back again. I do have your number.
Oh, I'll be back.
Thank you very much. So my last remarks is, for the Bahamas, be the reason that someone believes in the goodness of mankind. Let's be good to each other, Bahamas. Have a safe week. This is Urologist Speaks with Dr. Gregory Pinto. Good night. Just where you stand, tune in with us today.